Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the doctrine of parens patrae, right after this. You know, one of the things that people are concerned about is their children. People are concerned about their education in public school. They're concerned about drugs. They don't want their children to be turned into drug addicts. They want to be free to direct and discipline their children. And we find that there is a social involvement with a lady known as a social lady. Social lady, the social welfare department. And when we want to educate our children at home, we have social lady coming out and saying, no, you can't do that. And when we want to whip our kid, social lady comes out and says, no, you can't do that. We don't want to send our kid to public school, and social lady says, it's the law and you have to do that. And we say, we don't want our child taught sex education in public school, and social lady says, no, child needs to be taught that. We don't want evolution, and social lady says, no, sir, that isn't going to work. Now, that's the tip of the iceberg. There's probably 50 more things out there that you'd like to do with your children, and you find out that there are some limitations. These limitations are enforced under a doctrine of law called parens patrae. It's spelled P-A-R-E-N-S. P-A-T-R-I-A-E. And it deals with the fiduciary obligations and state power. Fiduciary obligations, that's your duty and your obligation and the power of the state to compel you to do that. Now, that's the exact opposite from what we see in the Ten Commandments, because when we look at the Ten Commandment model, you actually own your wife. And you pay a bride price to get her. Then there's a public ceremony in which the father disowns the daughter and then says, I'm going to give her to this young man here. And he's going to have the duty to feed her, clothe her, and house her. And then out of that, children come. And then these children, there's a question as to who owns them. Is it you? You ladies out there, do you have any ownership interest in these children that you're having? What's the king or the state's ownership interest in these children? And how does the state get any kind of an interest in them to start with? Now, when we got started at this back at Mount Sinai, we used to own our children. In fact, under the biblical law, if you had a child that was misbehaving, you could take that child out and stone him to death. The parents have the power, under the Ten Commandment law, of life and death over their child. But not under the civil law. You people out there, you know full well you wouldn't dare take your kid out and kill him. Hell, you won't even take your kid out of the public school. You're really fearful and timid now of this social lady, aren't you? And that's because you know that there's something fundamentally different between the biblical law, which says that children who disobey their parents and violate the fifth commandment are subject to the death penalty. The fifth commandment carries capital punishment for a child that doesn't mind his parents. Now, that may not be what we want. I'm not here to moralize and tell you we should go back to the law of God and kill our children and stone them to death because they're drug addicts or because they're out knocking old ladies over the head and stealing their purses. That's a political choice that you people have to make. But I just wanted to demonstrate here at the opening of the subject matter of parens patriae that there was a clear distinction between the common law that came from God and Moses at Mount Sinai and the feudal law that you're practicing today. A very clear distinction. I'll leave it up to you to decide which you would prefer to do. But the origin of this doctrine of parens patriae and the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in the maintaining and structure of feudalism. Now, chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties, and the concept of parens patriae was usually invoked in connection with the problems of property and guardianship. Notice here, it was to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another. Now, up in Washington State, they have what they call up there, what we would call here would be a Department of Employment. And so they've hung a new label on there. It's a Department of Human Resources. So I was curious about that, and I looked that up in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, and it's a legal term, human resource. And in feudalism, that human resource had to be renewed every generation. So what happens today is this. You're looking for a job. So you go down to the Department of Human Resources, and they say, we've got a job. They send you out to the warehouse or tree farm, tree plantation in some places they call those, and you can go to work there planting trees and harvesting trees until you're 65. And then we've got to have a transfer to the next generation. Well, the way this is affected is through the doctrine of parens patriae. See, you got a marriage license from the state of Washington, and then you got a birth certificate and gave that child to the state. That's what a birth certificate does. That's what a marriage license does. You work all of your life, and then when you die, your child takes your place. So we're doing the same thing today, but we don't call it feudalism. Today we call it human resource, the Department of Human Resources. So we change the names, and when we change these names, then we think that, well, that obviates, that somehow changes the law, and when in reality it doesn't. Now, going on here, later in response to the social and economic changes of the declining feudal age, statutes dealing with the custody of children by the poor were enacted, and the doctrine of parens patriae was used to justify involuntary separation of children from pauper parents. That's not proper, that's pauper, P-A-U-P-E-R, and subsequent apprenticeship to others. Apprenticeship? Apprenticeship, yeah. Similar provisions were common in the poor laws of the American colonies. In some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Undeserving parents who, for example, do not provide their children with good breeding or neglect their formal education, or parents who do not teach them a trade, or are idle, dissolute, unchristian, or incapable. So the concept of parens patriae, first used in chancery courts in England, were protection of feudal relationships and property, and were the major concerns, and later transplanted into a branch of the poor law, eventually came to suggest a general power or right of the state to intervene in intra-family affairs on behalf of the child or society, and to separate children from their parents. So in some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Now, the main elements of the doctrine were articulated in the famous 19th century English custody case of Wellesley versus Wellesley, in which the petition of a father against his deceased wife's sisters for custody of his minor children was denied on grounds that he was living in adultery and thus set a poor moral example for his children. So in his opinion, Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and that the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust, and that it does so because parents usually discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. Now, when this trust is not faithfully discharged, as when the parent is cruel, or who fails to maintain his child, or the state has the right to revoke the trust and to intervene on the child's behalf. So who decides? Well, the state decides. Where did they get that power? Now, as interpreted by most courts on this side of the Atlantic, the theory of parens patriae holds that parents' rights emanate from the state and are capable of being annulled by the state under certain circumstances in order to protect the welfare of the child. In some cases, however, a different rationale for state intervention is presented. It is to be remembered the court in Ex parte Krause, C-R-O-U-S-E, argued that the public has a paramount interest in the virtue and knowledge of its members, and that of strict right the business of education belongs to the state. The parents are, or ordinarily, entrusted with this because it can seldom be put into better hands. But where the parents are incompetent or corrupt, what is there to prevent the public from withdrawing their faculties, held as they obviously are, its sufferance? The right of parental control is a natural right, but it is not an unalienable right. Now here, the defeasible and defeasibility of the trust to parents is justified on the ground that child rearing affects interest beyond those of the parents and child, and that the state, as guardian of the social welfare, may, and perhaps must, intrude into family affairs when necessary to protect important social issues. Krauss thus adopted the doctrine of parens patriae not simply as a protective device for children against their parents. For the court in Krauss, the harmful consequence for the society at large of parental incompetence or unworthiness to rear children justly state intervention under parens patriae. Now, in the trust referred to by Lord Redesdale, the settlor or creator of the trust is the state. The trustee is presumably the child's natural parents, and the beneficiary of the trust, it's called a cestiqui trust, spelled C-E-S-T-U-I-Q-U-E trust, cestiqui trust, is the minor child. Now, in this context, it does not, of course, have its modern technical meaning of a trust of property, but in the early 19th century, before the development of the modern law of trusts, many matters of confidence were called trusts, whether or not there was any strict trust of property. It was said to have confidence reposed in him by B, where B had entrusted A with property to hold and to deal with on behalf of himself or others, and also where A had in some way undertaken to become B's agent. Now, outside the law, it is common usage to speak of a person entering some employment or taking up an appointment, whether public or private, as undertaking or accepting a trust. To avoid possible misunderstanding, however, it is perhaps best to use the word fiduciary to refer to the kind of relationship discussed in the theory of parens patriae. A relationship which is in some respects trust-like, but is not strictly speaking a trust. So a fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals. Now, a number of features of fiduciary relationships must be examined to appreciate fully the implications of applying the fiduciary concept to parenting. In a trust, the person by whom the title to property is held is called the trustee, are obligated to deal with the property for the benefit not of the trustees, but of the beneficiaries. The trustee, however, may himself be one of the beneficiaries. Similarly, in the fiduciary relationship between parents and the state, those who have custody of children are obligated to deal with them in such a way that the benefits of caretaking accrue to the others, either to the children themselves or as an ex parte crous to society at large. So this is not to say, of course, that parents may not also benefit from the care and nurture of their children. On the contrary, they typically enjoy the affection and companionship of their children, and they derive pleasure and a feeling of pride from seeing them grow and prosper and from the realization that they, the parents, played a major role in their becoming responsible adults. Now, although parents may be entrusted by the state with the task of caring for and protecting the well-being of their children, it does not follow that parents may not take their own interests into account in deciding and acting on behalf of their children. The fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals, nor does it require them to deny themselves these interests for the sake of the interests of their children or of society, as these interests have been antecedently defined by the state. To explain this point more fully, note the distinction in the law between instrumental and discretionary trusts. In both cases, the trustee has positive duties to perform. But in the former, that is the discretion, in the former, he is a mere instrument and his duties are such that anyone of normal competence could be expected to discharge them satisfactorily. While in the latter, he is called upon to exercise personal choice as to the manner in which the wishes of the settlor, the state, are to be carried out. The independence granted to the trustee allows his own interests to influence the execution of the trust, although, of course, his actions are still constrained by the general objectives of the trust. The trustee, who must use discretion and distribute benefits as he considers most suitable, may, to some extent, act so as to promote outcomes that are his personal goals or objectives. Similarly, if the fiduciary relationship between parents and the state is analogous to a discretionary trust, then within certain limits, parents are free to raise their children according to their own personal preferences. Now, the theory of parens patriae restricts parental autonomy in two ways. First of all, it stipulates that parents may not pursue their own self-regarding interests at the expense of, or in disregard of, the interests of their children. And then second, under this doctrine of parens patriae, the parents' objections to the standards of child-rearing imposed upon them by the state carry no moral weight as parental objections. Parents may legitimately criticize these standards, as anyone may, on the grounds that they're not good for society as a whole. But the parents may not criticize these standards on the grounds that the parents are a specific child's parents, or that these parents know what is best for their own child, or that they believe some other goals are more appropriate in their child's particular case. Since the theory of parents patrie regards parental authority over children as derived from the state, parents have no right, simply as parents, to define their own standards of child rearing and to demand that the state confine its requirements to minimal standards of care and education. The state might adopt minimal standards or maximal standards, but parental rights are merely creatures of the state, and individual parents have no independent source of authority on the basis of which to challenge the judgment of the state or the state's agents as regards the proper direction for parenting. So if the fiduciary relationship between parents and the state is analogous to a discretionary trust, then within certain limits, parents are free to raise their children according to their own personal preferences, but this is not an absolute right. Now, an important feature of the fiduciary relationship involving parents, children, and the state, and one that is independent of the parents patrie theory of the origin of parental rights, is that the rights of parents are tools given to them for the fulfillment of their judges, justices, and rights and obligations of the trustee, and it will vary according to only one thing, and that is his mission. Or so too the rights and obligations of parents, to the extent that parenting is analogous to a trust and it will depend solely on their mission. But who or what determines what the parent's mission is? Well, according to the doctrine of parents patrie, it is the state. And alternatively, we might consider the parent's mission to be self-imposed, their duties to be determined by their self-imposed mission, and their rights to be contingent on these duties. A parent, for example, might dedicate himself or herself to the end of raising this child to become a good Christian, provide him with a Christian education out of a sense of duty, and then defend the child's right or the parent's right to educate this child in this way on the grounds that it is necessary for the fulfillment of this duty to the state. Well, as a general thesis, however, this view of parental rights and duties as self-imposed is fundamentally mistaken. Because while parenthood with its attendant duties may be voluntarily undertaken, the duties are undertaken that attach to the role of parent in the organization of the family and are only dependent upon private parental decision. Indeed, it is not uncommon for parents to act out of deep moral conviction about their parental mission, and yet be totally mistaken about what their duty really is, and it is clear that objectively valid moral judgments about the treatment of children are not always reflected in the autonomous judgments of the parents. So the theory of parents patrie restricts parental autonomy. It stipulates that parents' objections to the standards of child rearing imposed upon them by the state carry no moral weight as parental objections. Now, if parents are parties to a trust-like relationship, is there any room in this conception for the notion of children's rights? Or are we compelled to regard the benefits that parents confer upon their children as mere gifts or favors that children are in no position to demand? Well, the belief that children themselves have no rights under the trusteeship, or this model perhaps stems from the assumption that trusts are a type of contract. It is, however, a well-established principle in the law that trusts may be enforced by a beneficiary who is not a party to it. While only the actual parties to a contract can normally sue upon it. The moral analog of this principle is based on the following considerations. If A and B contract with one another to the effect that A will provide some benefit to C in consideration of something that B does for A, then as a rule, C cannot validly insist that A perform his part of the bargain. A's failure to provide C with the promised benefit may disappoint C's expectations and may even harm him. But C is not in the strict sense wronged because, not having been a party to the original contract, C has no rights against it. The one who, properly speaking, has been wronged is B, and it is only he, B, who can be legitimately claiming the performance of A's duty as his due. Now, there is, however, an important exception to this rule. Suppose that B contracts with an insurance company and names C as his intended beneficiary. C, then, it seems, has a right to be accumulated funds after B's death, even though the insurance company made no promise to C. And the explanation for this, I submit, is that one of the contracting parties, the insurance company, is also a trustee of benefits for C. And it is because of the existence of this trust, not simply because there is a contract, that these contractual rights in favor of C may be enforced by him. C's right to the proceeds of B's insurance policy is not created by the insurance company's promise, but rather by B's naming C as his intended beneficiary. Now, I want to point out in this dialogue or this monologue that there is a cause and effect relationship that derives to this doctrine of parens patriae by the actions of we parents. You see, we the parents go to the state and we make a contract. It's called a marriage license. That's a contract. It's a three-party limited general partnership in which the state then comes into the contract with certain rights, certain property rights. And then the state comes up with a birth certificate and says, we want you to execute this birth certificate in favor of the state, which we all do. Then when social lady comes and knocks on our door and makes inquiry, we become bummed out. We become defensive and we say, wait, where did you get this power? And then the answer is, the state got its power by our consent when we got the marriage license and the birth certificate. That's what put parens patriae into effect in modern times. If we would go back to practicing the common law, if we would go back to practicing the law of Moses, the Ten Commandment model, and if we would avoid marriage licenses and birth certificates, we would go a long way toward ownership of a property right from the marriage that we call children.